Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Paul Karasik and Mark Newgarden. Both of them are award-winning cartoonists who have lectured and taught comics internationally. And we're talking about their new book, How to Read Nancy, The Elements of Comics in 3 Easy Panels. Paul and Mark, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Now, I have to admit, when I first heard about this book many months back, and the title was How to Read Nancy, I kept thinking, what? Of all the comics in the world that you really don't need a lesson to how to read, Nancy would be it. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And I just want to admit that in front of you, too. This is an amazing book. And a quote from you, everything you need to know about comics and understanding comics can be found in Nancy. How did you arrive at Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy as the perfect way to analyze comics?
I think Nancy chose us more than we chose Nancy. sort of at the end of our very long journey, we figured out that this book really could never have worked with any other strip, except perhaps Nancy.
Is it because it seems deceptively simple, that both visually and in the tone?
Well, you know, when we started this project back in the mid-'80s, we took this single comic strip and we dissected 9 aspects of comics language out of it. And we sort of thought, okay, well, you know.
Why stop there?
that was good enough, you know. But subsequently, Mark and I have both taught quite a bit, Mark at Pratt and the School of Visual Arts, and I teach a comics course at RISD. And we've been using the comic strip in the classroom, deconstructing it with students. And it just kept being endlessly deconstructible.
And for the benefit of the audience, and if you've not seen this book, it'll blow your mind. They take a single 3-panel strip from Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy that appeared in a newspaper, basically with Sluggo squirting people in the face saying, draw you varmint, and then there's a surprise panel at the end with Nancy and a hose. And you never even see Nancy's face in this comic strip. And they analyze it from 44 points of view, both content, context, and text. And I was skeptical learning about this project, and I find myself absolutely enthralled. Do you think you've hit the max of the way you could possibly analyze this strip? Is there anything left to be said about it?
I think if the original artwork were to show up, we might have an entirely new edition. But beyond that, I think we really stretched it about as far as we could without feeling like we were stretching it. Hopefully everything sort of holds up on its own, and we didn't cross any lines.
Now, looking at this, the first thing I wanted to know, and luckily you provide other Nancy strips at the end of this book by which to analyze every one of those points of view. And that was really helpful because you started to fix those ideas in your mind. And I thought that was pretty brilliant. But other than Nancy, can you apply all of these same issues to other newspaper comic strips?
Theoretically, yes, to any comic strip.
But it's going to be sort of a minimal panel comic strip, you think? Or
Well, we chose specifically a 3-panel comic strip because 3 is sort of the first of number implying sequence, and 2 wouldn't have done it. 4 would have been overkill, and I think 3 could
there's
be.
A reason,
go ahead.
Yeah,
Paul.
There's a reason why there's 3 little pigs.
That's right, and 3 witches and 3 wishes.
Exactly.
Just to give the audience an example, and how interesting you get, you actually talk about the space between the panels. And I actually found that discussion really helpful and useful. Let's talk about that. What they're called panel gutters. What is the function of panel gutters?
Well, it's sort of this interesting, almost metaphysical realm in between any two given panels, you know, where time and space and point of view all mutely commingle and land you in a different time and a different space and a different possible point of view or any combination of the 3. I think that Einstein could probably spend a lot of time in between the panels of any two given panel for the comics did.
Well, you know, and I started to imagine. I started to write those that comic story that occurred in between those two panels. Mm. I mean, you start to wonder what exactly, who went where, what, you know, how did this happen? And then you realize that there's an sort of a story written in the reader's mind of what occurred between those panels, and that's what the function of panel gutters are.
Absolutely. I think we make a little bit of an attempt to, like, you know, demonstrate where one could possibly go in between those panel gutters, and we cut ourselves short, but that could literally go on for infinity.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. It could be an entire study, actually, what happens in a gutter. It's extraordinary that the brain is able to jump from two different, let's say, just locations, you know, that were time or space. It could be the first panel could be set in the present, the second panel could be set 1,000 years in the past, and yet the brain makes that leap of, you know, 30 seconds of an inch and no problem readjusting itself.
Well, you know, that would be an interesting study, is what people, how people are following that. Like, you seem to automatically write the flow in your mind without really consciously being aware of it. And a person who designs a comic brilliantly, it'll be a brilliant flow across the three panels.
Exactly. And vice versa, yes.
Yeah. And there's even an invisible panel, the fourth panel, and you end the analysis with the fourth panel. What's the fourth panel?
In this case, the fourth panel is each of our individual imaginations taking where a loaded pistol hose, and an advancing bully might land us. Everybody's got a different variation of how and why and when those elements come together, but I think it's one of these cases where the slapstick is best left in the mind of the reader for maximum effect.
Now, you go through a lot of other analysis in these three panels of this one strip, and you bring up a lot of questions about Nancy in general while you do so, and one of them is, Bushmiller did this comic for so many decades, yet we know so little about Nancy, Sluggo, and the other people in the comic strip. It's absolutely kept minimal. It's until you start to reflect on that, you realize how bizarre that is. Even the design of the house, as you talk about, are absolutely barely minimal.
Yeah, highly intentional on Bushmiller's part. He really wanted a high degree of accessibility to any reader in any place, as well as a certain degree of application to anyone's life. Anybody's brain can kind of fill in a lot of these blanks, and these characters can kind of be substitutions or step-ins for ourselves to almost, you know, endless degree.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that so we might not know a lot about the history and upbringing of any particular character in the Nancy universe. We know exactly as much as we need to know about each one of them individually for the gag to function. And first and foremost, that was Bushmiller's mission in life, was to get the gag across.
Yeah, we don't even know Nancy's last name.
And the thing is, you don't even think about it having read the comic strip for decades. Until I started reading about in your book, and I realized I don't know crap about this comic.
Well, and she's Aunt Fritz. Like, okay, that means that either one of Nancy's parents had a sister named Fritzy. And then you think, what, Nancy had parents?
Well, you know, and the way you, because he keeps it minimal, you end up, as the reader, filling in all those details in your head automatically without considering it. Like, I never really thought about Nancy being an orphan or what her story is. And then poor Sluggo. You know, so Sluggo's economically disadvantaged?
I mean, oh, absolutely, yeah.
Is he? I don't know.
We get to see the interior of his home with enough frequency to, you know, gauge that it's in pretty poor repair. I think a couple, early sort of continuities in the strip involved aunts and uncles that kind of came and went out of his life, but he'd never really lived with them. He's evidently, like, completely self-sufficient, living in or outside a junkyard.
Wow. I want to talk about, you mentioned in the beginning of the book, the challenges of gathering material for this book. And one of the problems was that old newsprint is really now difficult to find. Talk about that.
Well, there's an interesting situation with old newsprint, which is actually finding an original. Well, we were, to begin with, we were absolutely dedicated to the principle that any reproduction in this book would be derived from an original source material rather than reprinting or particularly microfilm, which led us to an interesting discovery, which was that finding original newsprint in libraries from across the planet from, say, 1932 is much easier than finding original newsprint from 1960, because sometime around the mid-50s, the libraries started to just store newspapers on microfilm, which is a terrible way to, you know, it's okay for just information, but if you're really trying to look at the nitty-gritty and the objectness of the object, microfilm is a sorry
It really
excuse.
Is. No. And the other thing you talk about in the book is that for many people who originally read this strip, they didn't see it the same way that we see it in the book. And we see in the book, it's very clean, black and white. But newsprint had this weird, some of it had this weird ability to turn everything into not quite blacks and weird grays. Talk about that.
A lot of it had to do with the vagaries of the specific press that was being used in the specific location. The specific copy that you as the reader bought may not look at like the copy that your cousin bought across town. These were, you know, we think of this as mass media, but all of mass media boils down to, like, you know, one-of-a-kind objects. There's no escaping it.
Right. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Paul Karasik and Mark Newgarden. Both are award-winning cartoonists who've lectured and taught about comics internationally, and we're talking about their new book. I cannot recommend it enough. How to Read Nancy, The Elements of Comics in Three Easy Panels. The term you use in the book to describe Bushmiller's work is concise vigor. Elaborate on that.
Well, it couldn't be more concise.
No, you know? Three panels.
There's nothing extraneous. The case in point, the comic strip, which we can deconstruct in over 40 examples, there's not a single line made there that is excess. There's nothing overtly decorative there that is not serving a purpose.
And Bushmiller worked really, really hard to reduce all the elements to their essentials.
Yes, exactly. This was something of an obsession of his, and I think it's one that he pursued to the end of his life. He wanted to get that focus harder and harder and crisper as time went on. Get the gag faster. Get the gag down faster.
And it was all about the gag. The gag was paramount to Ernie Bushmiller.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the vigor part of that's a little bit interesting because, you know, we can look at some other mass, you know, market comic strips of the same era and even find cartoonists doing something that's probably even more approaching minimalism. Otto Soglow Barnaby Crockett Johnson. But there is in Nancy, like, you know, for something that's often thought of as being extremely simple and extremely sort of basic, quite a bit of expression and quite a bit of action going on in the actual cartooning itself.
You actually write, to consider Bushmiller an architect is entirely appropriate. And you use that term for him to actually build and construct these panels together.
Well, and ultimately, you know, I think we're making a case here for considering Nancy as a blueprint for what comics can be and what
That's
comics
right.
are.
Let's talk about Bushmiller's life, because the other part of this book, and for which I'm forever grateful, is that you really did your homework and put together a tremendous biography of Ernie Bushmiller. He had a 63-year career that started in 1919 at the age of 14. Where did he start?
He started at the New York World, sweeping up the art room, basically, as a office boy and sort of general factotum, and wanted to be a cartoonist from the very beginning and literally worked his way up that ladder.
And it seemed like I know this is true for many other comics artists, they went through several other comics on their route to finding that one defining comic that would be identified with them. And what was fascinating for me is to look at some of his early work, which was incredibly complicated. I'm thinking specifically of the Ingenuities and the Red Magic work he did. Let's talk about those two things, because when I look at those, I don't see Ernie Bushmiller's work at all.
It's there primarily in the lettering.
Tom, what were the Ingenuities?
Ingenuities was a series of an insert within the New York World newspaper that had puzzles and short stories and games, like an entertainment insert.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bushmiller's first work there was to do some spot illustrations there. You know, he was just a kid hanging around the art department, and they needed somebody to draw, you know, a chess piece or two, and he gladly stepped up to the plate. But more importantly, perhaps, in the oeuvre of Bushmiller's work is that he was also in there in Ingenuities ruling and blacking in the spaces in the earliest crossword puzzles, which was just a new fad that was starting.
Yeah, so his drawing and design training was simultaneous, which we think is very important in making our case.
Harry Houdini had something to do with the Red Magic insert.
Yeah, that was an insert that came a little bit later in New York World, a weekly puzzle and game section ostensibly edited by Harry Houdini. And evidently, we've been told by people who are close enough to Bushmiller to know that he did spend a good amount of time with Houdini working out some of the games and tricks and puzzles that went into that magazine.
And he even worked for Harold Lloyd, the movie actor, on one film.
Yes, he was tempted to come out to Hollywood. This is after he had taken over the Fritzy Ritz strip from another cartoonist and brought an awful lot of gag expertise to it right away. And people in Hollywood were taking notice. Hollywood, a lot of silent comedy is obviously built around the same sort of talent that it takes to make visual comedy on a comics page. And Lloyd was a fan. Lloyd was clipping strips and invited Bushmiller out to work on one of his earliest and probably his best early sound film, Movie Crazy.
Jeez.
In 1932.
And as I mentioned, he goes through a couple of different strips that he sort of starts and then fall apart. Was that really typical for comic artists to like come up with some idea for a strip and then it just sort of runs out? It's not that great and he moves on to another one. I'm thinking of things like Jibes of Jib and Jab and special rates for actors, you know, these weird strips that he would do that would last a certain number and then you're just sort of not working on them anymore.
Well, I think that these things catch on or don't catch on. Those particular examples that you're using actually come from the Ingenuity section and were sort of part of that section and were not necessarily considered to be ongoing series. However, the idea of cartoonists starting and comic strip after comic strip until something sticks, the corollary here with Bushmiller is that he had inherited this comic strip called Fritzy Ritz.
Yeah.
And he tried to introduce a child character into that strip. And he had Fritzy Ritz, who eventually became Aunt Fritzy, had several nephews come into the strip as young children. And they didn't really last too long. An example here, an example there. Then 6 or 8 months would go by and he'd try a nephew,
a cousin, an office boy. I mean, he was clearly trying to develop a sort of problem-solving younger character. And for whatever reason, they would come and go, didn't quite catch on. And when he finally tried one more variation, which was switching the sex of his character and introducing Nancy, as he put it, it instantly clicked.
It was, for me, it was interesting to reading about Fritzy Ritz, Nancy's aunt, because I'm assuming that's in the current Nancy strip, Aunt Fritzy is Fritzy Ritz, right? I mean, that's her.
Yep.
That's her.
So she led a wild life as a flapper.
Yeah, and eventually settled down to a life of domesticity with this little niece who needed to be kept an eye on.
But it's really now nice to really think when you look at the occasional appearances of Auntie Fritz that she really led a very crazy life as a flapper. I love that. When did he do his first straight on Nancy strip?
Well, Nancy comes into the actual strip. She's introduced in early January 1933. His idea was to bring her in for a week or two, you know, sort of do whatever gags he could get out of the situation and let her go. And got pretty instant feedback from some of his peers and colleagues, as well as the public, that this was a character they wanted to see more of. And he gradually brought her back again and again.
One of the things is, it's interesting watching the evolution of Nancy from Fritzy Ritz. He really starts using these blacks, very effectively, creating a flow in the comic. And you talk about that as one of the ways to analyze this. Talk about that. I mean, he really, like Nancy's hair is a classic example of that, of using black very, very effectively in the comics. But that wasn't there in the earlier comics so much.
Well, comic strip characters need trademarks. You know, Charlie Brown has that zigzag shirt.
Yep,
so that
yep.
Even when he is a 16th of an inch high at the end of the baseball field, you still know it's Charlie Brown in the rain. Nancy's got her hair. So that in part, it's just to brand the character. You give it this identifying look. But that black also, as we point out in the book, is very useful in helping move the eye along, because
right.
This is one of the most important tasks of a cartoonist, is to keep the thing rolling along, keep the eyeball rolling to get to, in this case, the gag.
Well,
graphic design is a very important aspect of cartooning.
One of the interesting things you do in this, among many in this book, is you show a full page from the newspaper of all the strips laid out, as a person who bought the newspaper would see them. And your eye immediately is drawn to Nancy because of the use of those blacks. And you realize how brilliant it was, his use of that sort of negative space.
He was thinking very, very strategically. He really did want his comic strip to be read first, to be seen
right,
first.
Right, and it worked. I mean, the thing is, it worked. And it, thanks to you guys, you know, you really point it out. And it's amazing when you start looking at it and you realize, God, this really is brilliant. It's absolutely smart. Now, one of the other things he did, and I started looking up a lot of other Nancy strips, he broke the fourth wall a lot of times, and you sort of don't think about that of Ernie Bushmiller, where he, as the artist of the strip, has an effect on what's going on in this strip. Talk about that.
Well, there are many cartoonists who broke down the fourth wall in that meta fashion. Early notables would include, say, Winsome Kay, who often would have characters actually talking to the reader. So, and Bushmiller was very aware. He loved comics, and he read comics when he was a kid. He knew that this was something that could be done. And he just, bit by bit, introduced it in a fairly, you know, regular fashion over the years as being another aspect to this particular comic strip that occasionally, particularly around national holidays, the fourth wall would come tumbling down and you would realize, oh, there's a cartoonist here at work.
Yeah, he loved to point out, take great lengths to invest an insane amount of work to point out how lazy he was as
That's
a cartoonist.
That's right.
Which couldn't be further from the truth.
I know.
Actually.
When did he give up the strip? You really have some interesting things about towards the end of his life. He kept on it as long as he could. How long did he do the strip for?
Well, he never actually quite let go, although, you know, age and Parkinson's made it tougher for him to do, you know, much of the drawing. But towards the very end, he had used assistants throughout his career, as most any cartoonist who have to deliver five daily strips and a Sunday strip.
Wow.
Did in those days. Very, very few cartoonists didn't use assistance of some sort. But at a certain point, he was working with a cartoonist on the Sunday pages named Al Plastino. Paul can give us a little background maybe on Al Plastino's completely antithetical work to the world of Nancy.
Yeah, I talked to Al Plastino a couple of times, and a delightful guy to talk to. He was a cartoonist in his own right, but he was known in the syndicate and comic book world as a guy who could really mimic anyone's style.
Ah.
Among DC Comics fans, he's lauded as being sort of the best Superboy artist. But he secretly and silently was probably a ghost for any one of the dozen strips over his career, because he could draw. You could draw in any style. But he said very firmly that of all the styles he worked in, that drawing like Bushmiller was the hardest. He had to hold his breath and turn the paper upside down to get that curve of Sluggo's chin, say, exactly right. And if you get either of those dots that mean eyeballs off just a micromillimeter,
it doesn't
work. Longer Nancy or Sluggo.
It doesn't work. We're almost out of time. I want to mention that among the many pleasures of this book is an entire history of hose jokes in comics.
Not entire. We only take it up to the end of the 19th century.
Now, there's a lot of French comics in this section that are fascinated by hoses suddenly going off. Is there any reason for that? Why are the French so fascinated by hoses squirting in people's faces?
They were modern. It was a modern tool, an implement. And anytime you enter a new element, a new object into the vernacular, this suddenly the as soon as there were enough hoses around for people to recognize what a hose was, then it's fodder for a gag.
I mean, hoses do go back to ancient times, but pressurized municipal water doesn't. that's sort of where the distance lies.
It was just there's a whole other book in this book of hose humor.
it's about six other books in this book, I think.
We're completely out of time. My guests tonight have been Paul Karasik, Mark Newgarden, both of them award-winning cartoonists who have lectured and taught comics internationally. And we're talking about their new book. It is just, there's a lot in here that is just so much fun and interesting, and you will cause you to look at comics differently. How to Read Nancy, The Elements of Comics in 3 Easy Panels. Guys, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.